Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we will continue with our study of the Sutta Nipata, and today we will take the next sutta on the list. This is the Alavaka Sutta. This is sutta number, it's in the Uragavaga Sutta number 10. And like the Hemavata Sutta, this sutta also involves a yaka or a demon. This demon is named Alavaka because he was dwelling near a town in northern India named Alavi. And this sutta has a certain background story which is told in the commentary to the Sutta Nipata. Again, when I relate these background stories, I have to give a sort of word of caution that comes with it, a little bit like a word of caution on a bottle of medicine, that the background stories from the commentaries, you can believe them, not believe them. Sometimes they're not really believable, but this is part of the tradition, and so it's also interesting to have a knowledge about the background story, whether one considers it believable or not. Okay, according to the background story, there was a king reigning over the state of Alavi. The state of Alavi had its capital city, was also named Alavi. And this king was fond of hunting. And one day, together with his courtiers, he went out hunting for deer, and he saw an antelope running through the field, and he left his courtiers and went chasing after the deer. He caught the deer, killed the deer, and then he was bringing the deer back with him, and then he stopped to rest by a cave. And this cave was the haunt, the dwelling place of the demon Alavi. The demon Alavi, or the demon Alavaka, saw the king and grabbed him. And it's the practice of these demons to devour human beings, these fierce, ferocious demons devour human beings. And so this demon grabbed the king and was about to devour the king when the king pleaded with the demon and said, "Please spare my life. I am the king of this country. I am indispensable for the administration of the land." And so the demon said, "If I spare your life, what good is it going to do me?" Then the king said, "You exist, you need human flesh, so I promise that every day I will send you a human being together with an offering of rice, a kind of rice preparation, rice and honey preparation." And then the king said, well, what guarantee do I have that you will not deceive me? Then the king said, I give you my solemn promise that if any day I do not send you a human being as a sacrifice, as an offering, you can come to my palace and you can take me and devour me. That is my promise. Okay, so the demon agreed to release the king. And so the king went back to the palace. He was very disturbed because he had made this agreement with the demon. But he realized he had to fulfill it. And so he consulted with his personal advisor. The personal advisor said, don't worry about it, King. You leave everything to me. A little bit like George Bush says to Karl Rove, you leave everything to me. Okay, so the personal advisor went to the prisons and started taking out prisoners one by one and sending them to the demon as offerings. Each day he would send the prisoner, he would take the prisoner and say, would you like to be free? The prisoner would say, yes, I would like to be free. And so then the advisor would say, well, all you have to do is take this offering of rice, you go to this particular cave, you leave this offering at the foot of the cave, then once you do that, then you can go free. And so the prisoner would take the offering, go to the foot of the cave, and then he would be grabbed by the demon and devoured. Okay, so after some time, the demon had devoured all of the prisoners in the land. Then the advisor reported this to the king. They wondered what to do next. And so this was the sad conclusion they reached, that first they considered, should we give the old people? But then they reported this to the people, and people said, but the old people, those are our own mothers and fathers. We can't give them away. So then they decided, what we will do, we will give our own children. And so each day they would give a child to be given to the king, and then he would give that to the demon. This is why I say the story becomes somewhat unbelievable. But then after some time, all of the people with children left the kingdom until there were no more people with children left in the kingdom. Except the king himself had a young son. And so when all of the other children had been given away, the day came when the only child left in the kingdom was the son of the king, that was the prince, the young prince, who was just a little baby, an infant. And so the next day was to be the turn for the king to offer his own son to the demon. Okay, this day the Buddha was traveling through the country, and he had come to the state of Alavi, and he was sitting in meditation early in the morning. He had entered into the attainment of great compassion, and then when he emerged from that attainment, then he looks out over the world with his supernormal vision, with the vision of a Buddha, and he saw that first that this young infant was destined to become, that he had the potential upon growing up to become a non-returner. who would become one of his most distinguished lay disciples. He also saw that the demon, Alavaka, had the potential to become a stream enterer, a sotapanna, if he received the proper teaching. And he saw that this demon was on the verge of encountering that young prince, and through this concatenation of karmic conditions, was going to devour the prince. If you remember a few weeks ago when I spoke about the yakshas, I said that the yakshas are beings who have, at one level, they have this terrible, horrific, demonic nature, but many of them, deep within, have a hidden divine potential, which is just covered over by this demonic, the superficial demonic nature. And because they have this inner divine potential, if they are presented with suitable Dhamma teaching, that divine potential can be awakened, can be aroused, can be activated. And with the activation of that divine nature, their spiritual faculties can also be activated, and they are thereby capable of attaining the paths and fruits of enlightenment. And so the Buddha knew that this demon Alavaka had the potential for enlightenment, and now, out of compassion for both the demon and the little infant, he was going to the cave of the demon Alavaka. Again, according to the commentary, at the time that he arrived at the cave, the demon Alavaka was away from the cave. The commentary said that he had gone to the Himalayan mountains to attend a conference of yakshas. It seems that these yakshas are always holding conferences in the Himalayan mountains. A little bit like business executives or politicians. They pack their suitcases, and they don't have to take planes, but they fly off in their special private jets off to the Himalayan mountains to attend their conferences. Okay, so while the demon Alavaka was in the Himalayan mountains, the Buddha arrived at the cave, entered the cave, sat down on the demon's, Alavaka's, special seat, and was preaching to Alavaka, the demon's harem, his harem of wives. Word of this spread through some chain of gossip. They spread up to the Himalayan mountains, where the demon Alavaka heard about this, and he became furious, boiling over with anger. So in a huff, in a hurry, he left the Himalayan mountains, came rushing back down to the state of Alavaka, furious with the Buddha, in order to throw the Buddha out from his cave. And it is at this moment that the sutta opens. Okay, so we now come to the text of the sutta. Okay, the opening part in prose, I can just read that once the Buddha was dwelling in the residence of the Yaka Alavaka near the town of Alavi. Then Alavaka came to the Buddha and shouted, "Get out, recluse." And then the Buddha departed, saying, "Very well, friend." Then the Yaka ordered him, "Come in, recluse." And the Buddha said, "Yes," saying, "Yes, friend." The Buddha entered. For a second time, the yaka shouted to the Buddha, "Get out, recluse." Again, the Buddha departed. For a second time, the yaka ordered, "Come in, recluse." And then the Buddha again entered. For a third time, the yaka shouted, "Get out, recluse." And for a third time, the Buddha departed, saying, "Very well, friend." Okay, here we have what might seem to be a rather bizarre scene, that this demon is ordering the Buddha, and each time the Buddha is obeying these commands of the demon. Why is the Buddha following the demon's commands? The reason the Buddha is following this, the Buddha's commands, is in order to soften up the mind of the demon, in order to prepare the mind of the demon to receive instructions. This we can say that this is a process of ripening the spiritual faculties of the demon. If when the demon ordered the Buddha to get out, the Buddha were to say, "No, I won't get out," then the demon would just get angrier and angrier, and there would just be a contest, a battle between them. And then the demon would become inaccessible to instruction. But if the Buddha would just go on continuously obeying the demon's orders, then it would seem that the demon had vanquished the Buddha, was superior to the Buddha, and the demon would then, since he regarded himself as superior to the Buddha, then again he would be inaccessible to the Buddha's instructions. But by going out, coming in, going out, coming in, the demon, the Buddha is showing that he has a certain flexibility of mind. And so the demon is now coming to realize that the Buddha is not somebody who's stiff and rigid. And so the demon is warming up to the Buddha, gradually warming up to the Buddha. But now, a third time, the demon orders the Buddha, for the third time the yaksha shouts, "Get out, recluse," and for a third time the Buddha departed, saying, "Very well, friend." I think that the translation is faulty here. All right, the Buddha obeys the instructions the third time. It's when Alavaka shouted the orders to the Buddha a fourth time, saying, "Get out," a fourth time. That time, the Buddha says, "I will not obey you, and you can do whatever you like about it." Okay, then the demon says, "I shall put a question to you, and if you do not answer, then I will overthrow your mind, or I will tear out your heart, or take you by the feet and throw you to the other side of the river." So you could see from this that this is not a very polite and accommodating demon. But the Buddha now shows his true nature and says, in this world, together with its gods, Maras, Brahmas, or human beings, I do not see anyone who could overthrow my mind or tear out my heart or take me by the feet and throw me to the other side of the river. However, the Buddha says, you may ask your question. And whatever you ask, I will answer you. Okay, and now we come to what we might call the real substance of the Alavaka Sutta. And in the first part of the sutta, we have a series of 8 questions which are distributed into 2 sets of 4 questions. And it's these 8 questions that I'm going to take in today's discourse. The remainder of the sutta I will take next time. But when we look at these 2 sets of 4 questions, we will see that the 2 sets fall into 2 categories. If you remember, I've spoken time and time again about how the Buddha's teachings fall into 2 basic categories. That is, teachings which are concerned with welfare and happiness, concerned with mundane existence, that is, with life in this world as well as in future lives, and then that aspect of the teaching which is concerned with supramundane realization, with liberation, with ultimate enlightenment. So we have these 2 sets of 4 questions, and if we reflect upon the answers, the questions and the answers, we'll see that the first set of 4 questions and answers are concerned with well-being and happiness in the mundane dimension of human existence, with happiness in this life and in future lives, while the other set of 4 questions and the answers are concerned with ultimate liberation. Even though there appears to be a certain amount of overlapping between the two. Okay, so the first set of 4 questions. And here I'll recite first in Pali, then give the translation. King Sudavitang Puri Sasasetang King Su Sitsuchinang Sukamavahati King Su Hafe Su Tutarang Vasanang Katang Jiving Jivitamahusetang. And then the answer comes. Well, let me translate the questions. Okay. Alavaka's questions. What here is the best wealth for a man or for a person in this world? What is the good practice that brings happiness? What is the sweetest of all tastes? What manner of living is said to be the best or the noblest kind? And then the Buddha's answers. Sadidavitang puri sa sasetang Dhammo suchino sukhamavahati Satchang have Sadhu tarang rasanang panya jiving jivitamma husetang. Okay, the Buddha's reply in English. Confidence, or I prefer to say faith, is the best wealth for a person here in this world. The Dhamma, well practiced, brings happiness. truth is the sweetest of all tastes, and living by wisdom is said to be the best, or the one who lives by wisdom is said to live the best. Okay, in the Buddha's reply, he is pointing to four basic virtues that I would say are essential to wholesome and virtuous living here in this world. And we begin at laying the very foundation for virtuous or righteous living with this virtue called Sadda, or faith. And what is meant by faith is not necessarily just blindly believing certain propositions, but I consider faith to be the trust, confidence, belief in the reality of a, let's say, a realm of spiritual values, to be trust in the functioning of an ethical and spiritual law that we cannot immediately see and verify through our senses. We learn about the reality of these spiritual values. We learn about the functioning of this spiritual, ethical law through wise, enlightened sages who have been able to directly realize it through their higher wisdom. Various sages through the centuries have testified to the validity of these values, the functioning of the spiritual law. The one who is for us as Buddhists, who has realized it in its fullness, in its most complete form, is the Buddha himself. And so we as the basis for our lives, we take this confidence, this trust, this conviction and commitment to this domain of spiritual values. And this domain of spiritual values makes demands upon us. It makes demands upon us for self-sacrifice. It challenges us to place the demands of our own ego in the background and to be willing to place other values ahead of the urges, the impulses that come from, you might call, the lower ego self. And we accept the reality of these demands that are thrust upon us by faith in the confidence that by following these demands, this will bring our long-range welfare and happiness. At the beginning, it seems to us that these demands are unpleasant and disagreeable because we would like to get more worldly pleasures. We would like to build up our name and fame. We would like to get more power. We would like to go on just indulging our desires. But we become aware of the spiritual law which says that the way to welfare and happiness lies through following ethical laws, by following precepts, by practicing generosity, by self-sacrifice. And so we place faith, first we might have faith in teachers, faith in doctrines that we might learn, faith in individuals, And then gradually our faith widens and deepens until this becomes the kind of bedrock for our lives, until this faith becomes the most important motivating factor in our lives. And then we build up all the other aspects of our lives upon this faith, so we're ready to go through great trouble, great tribulations, in order to win this higher good that comes through making these sacrifices, meeting these challenges. And for this reason, the Buddha says that confidence or faith is the best wealth for a person here in this world, not to speak of the ultimate good, nirvana, liberation. But even in this world, it doesn't mean that confidence is going to make, or faith is going to make us a millionaire. It doesn't mean that we're going to get rich, get a good job. But this faith is what is going to bring us, in the long term, true well-being and happiness. Even if we are poor, even if we meet many difficulties, but that faith is the basis for leading a wholesome life, a virtuous life, a life built upon ethics, upon developing such qualities as love, compassion, helpfulness to others, and above all, the life of wisdom. And that is what will bring us the true Aryan wealth, the wealth of the noble ones. Okay, now it seems to me that the next three lines of this verse deal with, maybe this is the way I construe them, conduct of body, speech, and mind. The next line speaks of well-practiced Dhamma brings happiness. And I like to think of this line, though Dhamma is very general, but I like to think of this line as advocating the practice of harmlessness or non-violence in our conduct, so that we make, at the very minimum, not harming or injuring any other living beings through our, especially through our bodily conduct, or through the way we interact with others, the basis of our way of relating to others. And this brings us happiness, because we can say that what gives real happiness is the, at a mundane level, is the ability to interact with others in a peaceful and harmonious way. If one has a lot of wealth, high position, a lot of power, but one is not able to relate to others harmoniously, if there's a lot of friction, a lot of tension in one's relations with others, then one doesn't have happiness. Always there's arguments, always there's fighting, or else others, if they see that one is domineering, violent, argumentative, then they will avoid you, and then one becomes very lonely, very isolated. But if one is friendly, harmless, nonviolent, kind, compassionate, considerate, then people will be open, friendly, helpful, and then that will bring friendly and harmonious relations, and then that will give happiness. Okay, the next line speaks about truth as being the sweetest of all tastes. And this, I would say, is a virtue that relates to speech. And even though the Buddha spoke about this in his time, emphasizing the importance of truth in communications. Because in order for there to be any kind of integrated social order, that social order has to be founded upon a confidence that the people that one is relating to are speaking the truth. If one cannot have this confidence or trust in the communications of others, if there is suspicion or distrust, then the fabric that holds society together is starting to come apart. Or we should say the thread that holds society together as a kind of integrated fabric is starting to come apart, to disintegrate. And we see this happening more and more today, especially where in place of truth as the value that's cherished in communications, what is now emphasized instead is the impression that one's communications make on others. So that appearance is valued rather than truth value. This began maybe decades ago in the 1950s with the advertising industry. So that products, in order to sell, had been promoted by advertising, so everything became packaging and appearances. And within the realm of commerce, a certain degree of advertising and promotion is certainly understandable and acceptable. But unfortunately, a study of the techniques of advertising and promotion spread from commerce into politics, so that that particular sphere in which truth and honesty should be the prime consideration became gradually permeated and in times and eventually almost completely overwhelmed by the use of appearance and impression rather than truth. So today, communication from politicians, their spokesmen, is almost entirely spin, so that one doesn't know whether to trust any word coming from the dominant leaders within government, their spokesmen, competing from the opposition parties. Who is one to trust? Who is one to believe? And the consequences of this have been catastrophic through falsehoods presented as truths, through spin, through deception, through subterfuge, through forgeries. This country, this world has been dragged into terrible war, which has cost billions, over $200 billion, has cost thousands of lives, and we have to consider not only American lives. For some reason, our leaders only speak of American lives. They never think of the lives of people in other countries, the people who are affected by our disastrous actions. But they're also living beings, they're also human beings, just as much as Americans are. And so when falsehood prevails over truth, gradually all of the guiding principles which should lead a country and steer a country towards the fulfillment of the higher purposes of communal existence gradually become overwhelmed and undermined. And the only way to counteract that trend is by opposing this amoral or immoral drive for power and domination with the power of moral truth, by speaking truth ourselves and by demanding a return to moral truth from the leaders of our country, from our representatives, from our senators, and from the president himself. Not only our country, but from every country. Okay, truth is the sweetest of all tastes, and living with wisdom is said to be the noblest kind. Okay, living with wisdom, this means living with the guidance of right view, with samadhi. And this, we could say, is the supreme virtue in the domain of mental conduct. So, right view is what enables us to evaluate different courses of action in order to be able to determine, to decide, to judge what is truly beneficial and what is not beneficial, but actually harmful. And here we have to be able to discern and distinguish carefully, because there are two things that can easily be confused. That is, what is pleasant and what is beneficial. And what is pleasant might be beneficial, but it might be harmful. And what is beneficial might be pleasant, and it might be difficult or painful. When what is painful is harmful, then there's no choice between them. Then there's no problem in deciding. Everybody naturally will shy away from what is painful and harmful. When a course of action is pleasant and beneficial, naturally people will want to pursue that course of action, because people are attracted to pleasure, and if it's also beneficial, people will want to follow it. But it is when a course of action is beneficial but difficult to fulfill, that is, a course of action that makes demands on us, that requires us to make sacrifices, that requires us to change ourselves, to give up old habits, to break with maybe old friends, to develop new friendships. So it is that course that is beneficial but painful, that is what is difficult to pursue. It is when a course of behavior is pleasant but harmful that it is difficult to give up. That is also what is challenging and difficult. And that is where wisdom comes into play as a supreme virtue of the mind that leads to right living. So if one just follows instinct without letting oneself be guided by wisdom, then one will often just go along, follow the crowd, go along with what everybody else is doing, go along with what seems natural to do. One will be swept along by fashion. One will easily be duped by the words of deception, be taken in by appearances, by impression, by spin. Then one has no means of discernment, of discrimination. But it is through wisdom that one is able to see through the appearances and to know what is pleasant, but to realize that if one follows this particular course that's pleasant, it's going to lead to difficult circumstances in the future for oneself, for others, maybe even to catastrophes. And if one has an understanding of the law of cause and effect of action, the way one action will breed chains of reactions over time, reactions that multiply from one to another, then one will see how from one mistake, more mistakes can breed from one to another. Then one will keep away, keep at a distance from these wrong choices. That's why the Buddha says that when one undertakes a commitment to the rules of virtue, one sees danger even in the slightest faults. And then when one sees the benefits in those actions that are difficult to pursue, then one will follow those lines of actions even though they are difficult. This is like if one is trapped in a desert and one sees that on the other side of a range of mountains there is a beautiful meadows with towns and villages and lakes, and there's only one route leading across the desert to that beautiful, over the mountains to that beautiful meadow, then one will follow that route across the desert, even though it is difficult. And so when one sees the benefits in following a difficult course of action, with the guidance of wisdom, one will proceed, not deflected, not drifting, not deviating, but one will go straight ahead. And that is why the Buddha says, one who lives by wisdom is the one who lives best. Okay, maybe this will do for my talk this afternoon. I thank you all for your attention, and may the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, I will recite some verses to share the merits.
Akasata ca bhumata devanaga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata ca bhumata devanaga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata ca bhumata devanaga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu mam param. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.